You're listening to Potluck, the podcast that stirs up a unique flavor of people, culture, and brands in Asia. Hosted, as always, by Scott and Drago.
Hello and a warm welcome to Potluck and the second episode of Season 2. You're listening to me, Scott Percival, and as ever, I'm joined by Drago Durov. Drago, happy Chinese New Year. How are things with you in this new lunar cycle?
Hi, Scott. If winter comes, can spring be far behind? The Japanese call the new lunar year a new spring. So looking forward to a fresh breath of air. Today, we're stirring the pot with Ambrish Chaudhry, Head of Strategy and MD of Super Union in Singapore. Let me briefly introduce Ambrish. Ambrish started his career in India as a planner at Rediffusion, now part of the Dentsu Yang and Rubicam Group. Then he goes on to become a strategy consultant at TNS in Dubai, to then make his way to Singapore in 2010. One of his former colleagues at Super Union, Paul Caldwell, I've actually met Paul, you know. I'm not going to try and channel him now, but he says about Ambrish, good strat people are as rare as radium. It takes a combination of a high level of intelligence and a genuine interest in and sympathy for real people in the real world. Ambrish is absolutely first class, a pleasure to work with and great to spend time with. The airport lounges we have known. As good at listening as he is at talking, one of the best. Now, Ambrish, I'd love to hear someone say this about me, and we'd love to hear the lounge stories too. Thanks for coming to stir the pot with us.
Thanks for having me, guys. This is really exciting. Yeah, airport lounges make us whimsical now, don't they? Yeah, slightly wistful about that.
Super Union used to be Brand Union, yeah? But you've been with the company for a combined 11 years now. It's got to be some special place. Can you give us the elevator pitch, the tasting menu? What do you guys do and how would you describe it?
Yeah, sure. It really is a special place. And in some senses, it's been 11 years, but it feels like very different aspects to it, given that I was in multiple markets. But what's amazing about Super Union is just how similar the culture is across multiple markets. And the real ambition to create genuine impact for our clients and really sort of, almost be a little bit of a bit of a ballast in their business. We like to think that before we get on to a client engagement and after that, there is a difference in the trajectory of our client's business. That's how we work. We really try and link the brand to the business context and really help our clients grow their business both from an internal and an external perspective. So it's really very much around aligning the vision of the business with what the customers are looking for and how the brand can then sort of bridge the gap between the two. Mm. And it's amazing just how useful that is for businesses, particularly in Asia, where there's a certain growth cycle around brands and people are becoming much more conscious around branding. It's a brilliant time to be here and really privileged to do what we do.
Fantastic.
Thanks, Ambrish. So you've touched on a number of areas we're going to be delving into shortly. Now, to whet the appetite, we like our guests to kick off by thinking about their career path through perhaps an alternative or less typical lens as something of a recipe for where they've now got to, if you like, the dish that is Ambrish, if you like. So drilling down to the three main ingredients, what do you think would be the three main ingredients that have sort of defined that career path to date? What would they be?
Wow, that's an interesting analogy, and I've got to live up to sort of Paul's bigging me up as a strategist. So maybe I'll split it into three areas. I'll talk about an ingredient. I'll talk about a dish that the ingredient leads to, and I'll talk about a condiment, just because I'm strategic like that.
Lovely.
but I think as an ingredient. It's bland but really delicious is potato. And I think why potato is, as a strategist, you've got to be really flexible and you've got to understand that you're a part of a solution, and strategy itself isn't the solution. It leads to something delectable, right? So that's the role of good strategy. And I guess the idea around potatoes are just how flexible they can be and how you can sort of make multiple kinds of dishes and splice them in multiple ways. And I think that's what good strategy is. It's custom made to the end that you're looking for, as opposed to one way of doing anything. So yeah, that'd be the ingredient. Moving on to the dish, and I have to hark back to my days in the Middle East, not because I just miss the food so much, but there is an incredible salad, a Lebanese salad called fattoush, which is really, really interesting because it's fresh and it's delicious, but it's also, like, it's got things like croutons in it and this slightly sweet pomegranate molasses and sumac spices. So it's not really the healthiest salad you can have, but it is a salad and it is delicious. And I think that's what good strategy is, or good strategists are as well. They're not one flavor, you know. I heard very early in my career that it's great to sort of, you know, great strategists would enjoy the most highbrow and intellectual things and the most pop culture things as well. Mm-hmm. So I think in that sense, salad, but healthy as well. And I think the role of a condiment is to elevate the dish, right? And I think that's what, as a strategist, I aim to do, especially when we're having conversations with the C-suite around businesses, to elevate it significantly. And there's so many amazing chili sauces here in Asia. There's one at Tim Ho Wan, which I sort of I'm absolutely addicted to. So maybe that one, it just elevates the overall taste and elevates the overall conversation, which is what a strategist should try and do. And I've been lucky enough to have lots of those kinds of conversations with business leaders across Asia. So that's what I'd like to think.
Okay, let's not open up the chili sauce debate, or we could be here all day.
That could be the new podcast.
Yeah. That could be in itself.
Let's get to some more stirring. Obviously, no stirring can take place until the lid is off, because this is how we're all. So we're lifting the lid on Asia. And this is the segment where we try to get a sense of what's happening in our part of the world, whether our guests are based in the region right now, or have perhaps recently left or moved around, as is the case with Ambrish. But we want to get a sense of what Asia is to them. So, Ambrish, we know that you've worked on a variety of brand exercises with 7 out of 12 unicorns in Asia. That's quite a collection of scalps, if you would excuse the analogy here, but perhaps not the best one, especially as we know hair is overrated, yeah? But it's an amazing achievement. Can you tell us a bit more about that, perhaps a couple of examples?
Sure. I mean, if we're lifting the lid out of on Asia, right, it might be worthwhile for me to just talk through how I built my career and how those changes happened, those shifts happened. I've always sort of believed that, I've been working on markets of a billion. You know, I was growing up in quasi-socialist India, and it just opened up, and I literally remember sipping my first Pepsi, and it was this amazing thing. I was probably 8-9 years old, and there were advertisements everywhere, and it was. Can you feel the magic? I think was their tagline, and literally everyone was talking about it. So imagine being born in a world where there wasn't a Pepsi, and suddenly it was all these brands were coming in. So I knew there was something really special, and I fell in love with brands right then and there. And I could see just how people adapted quickly to a world full of these brands. And it was like they were allowing this wonder and magic into their lives and just so open to more of that. And honestly, when I look at my trajectory growing up there, I couldn't be anything but a brand strategist. Mm-hmm. So I saw the effect that brands had on people and how they filled their lives with positive aspiration, optimism firsthand. Since then, I moved to the Middle East, and again, it was more understanding the Muslim sort of consumer, and again, that's almost a market of a billion as well, and how there are, of course, there are differences, but how they engage with brands. And finally, in Southeast Asia, so when you say the 7 out of 12 unicorns, those are in Southeast Asia.
Right.
And again, the shift there was like, this is the next tranche of a billion consumers, with markets like Vietnam and Indonesia, and the Philippines growing rapidly. And been really, really lucky to see the impact that technology is having firsthand on these people. So, we branded Gojek way before Gojek really became Gojek. Mm. And one of the ways we did that was realizing very quickly that we didn't have to create anything special around Gojek. What we really had to do was understand the impact it was creating firsthand. And we rode with Gojek drivers, and we understood just what it meant to have the freedom for them to be, not have to sit around all day waiting for customers to come to them, in an 8-hour work day, sort of doing 2 or 3 rides, to suddenly having the access to this swath of consumers, for all these riders to suddenly realize that they don't have to wait to for a bus or a cab and spend 4 hours in traffic, and they can do it in an hour on a Gojek and stuff like that. So we literally saw how technology is changing lives on a daily basis in Asia. Mm. And I think that's a big part of how the Asian consumer is changing. I think they've just really shown their openness to engaging with technology, and even with things like social media. It's a thing of lore now that how Asian consumers actually spend more time than people in the West on that. But it's because technology is helping them leapfrog. It is making life fundamentally easier and simpler in multiple ways. And being in Asia, you get to see that firsthand, and that kind of perspective of even these founders who are creating these businesses, it's about touching millions of lives and improving millions of lives, and you see it on a day-to-day basis. It's actually, it can be quite humbling.
Can we talk a bit more about the role of brand? Experience you had in India is very similar to what I experienced in post-communist Bulgaria, I think. It was interesting you mentioned the inevitability of becoming a brand strategist. Can we talk a bit about the inevitability of brand and or the necessity of brand along the journey of a startup? Maybe there's an interesting Asian angle here, or maybe there isn't, but I have the sense that, say, for a Silicon Valley startup, they appear a lot more brand conscious kind of early on. Is there any difference with what's happening here? What's your experience, and what do you think are the implications for startups and unicorns here in Asia?
Sure. It's a great question. And I think particularly we're quite privileged that we've worked with all of these big sort of unicorns on their life journey. But we also try and share that with startups, and whether it's working with VCs and helping them brand, or sort of holding talks for early stage startups to learn from. And I think it's a bit of a philosophical question around what the right time for branding is. And this might sound really counterintuitive, but I think it might actually be in some senses better for some startups at the early stages to not be too influenced by brand. Of course, if there is a genuine purpose and the founders are actually trying to make the world better, and that's the motivation for starting the business, then great, of course, and that seeps through the culture throughout. But I feel that as an early stage startup, you've got to be quite flexible about who you are, what you want to be, and you want to sort of throw some of that out in the world, get the feedback, then respond, and then adapt to what you could be. So our experience is that after a certain time, most sort of founders and C-suites realize that their business has grown quite big, and what they sent out in the world has been received really well. And then they realize that, the teams have been growing dramatically, and they realize that perhaps some of that initial sense of purpose or that culture is beginning to be lost. I think that's the right time to come in, because you try and understand the impact that the brand is making on the consumers' lives. You try and get the ambition and aspiration of the founders, and you try and get a sense of why more people are joining the company, and you mix all of that, and then you try and capture and bottle what made the company what it is, because then the company is also a lot surer of what it is and what it wants to be. There is, of course, the Silicon Valley way of starting with a very brand-based approach, but I think in some senses, that also perhaps makes them a little bit inflexible because they're very, very sure of exactly what they want to be. And I don't know if what they want to be and the vision of what the world wants them to be is always the same. In fact, it's quite philosophical around this whole Silicon Valley model and the Chinese or Asian way of setting up startups, because Silicon Valley is very much about specialization. So I'm going to stand for one thing, and I'm going to make sure that, you know, more and more people come to me for that one thing, versus, you know, what sort of tech businesses in China have shown is that it's almost the share of attention, right? Like, if you can get the user's attention, then it's almost a race to a super app, because you can do more and more and more things with them. And which is why here you see Grab, you know, companies like Grab, you know, starting with ride hailing, but now also getting into your financial services, etc. And I think very much for the Asian customer, there is the Asian model, which is, you know, if I trust a company, because trust is such a premium, then I trust them to do more and more for me, which is almost the antithesis of the Silicon Valley model. And increasingly, when I speak to founders here, they're much more influenced by the China tech model, and most of them would love to have more Chinese investors on board, because that's the kind of ambitious, almost audacious thinking that drives them. And I think that sits really well with both the consumers and founders in Asia. So.
Okay, so Ambrish, we know that beyond the startup scene, as you alluded to, you've had this really interesting mix of vantage points from, you know, beginning in India, then moving to the Middle East, and then back to Singapore. And you're obviously working with, you know, boardrooms and C-suites across industries, across Asia. Pulling back from that, what have you noticed about the role that brand plays, especially now? So I know you've got some views regarding, for example, what the CMO can bring to the table as part of that. You know, how much the sort of, gravitas and kind of credence, if you like, the CMO is given to shape the way the business, not just the brand, but, you know, the business grows as part of that. So, yeah, tell me some more about that, please.
Yeah, how much time do you have? It's really, really interesting, because, you know, we've been so not only have I had access to the Asian or the Middle Eastern or the Indian markets as Super Union, right? We're about, you know, just about 700 people across the globe, so we're really well connected, and a lot of our projects are multi-market, etc. as well. So I've done a fair few projects in North America and Europe as well, and you get to sort of contrast that a little bit with the kind of work you do in Asia. And I think in Asia we're particularly lucky given how much the brand is on the C-suite agenda, and given that a lot of branding projects are more than just branding projects, right? It's about meaning. And that's why the access and the involvement of the CEO, for example, is extremely high. So in some senses, you know, I could go to the C-suite, I could go to the CEO and say, you know, Miss CEO, your brand isn't as effective as it could be, and it could be doing more. And that might give me some credibility get me some attention. But if I go to the CEO and say, you know what, Miss CEO, we know you have this expansive vision for the business, but there is a gap between how that vision is being perceived internally and externally, and we're going to use the brand as a conduit to sort of bridge that vision, that conversation, I think, goes a lot better, because that's sort of what's keeping them up at night. And in that sense, I think the role of the brand is crucial, because it really allows that kind of business shift to happen. And in some senses, you know, I keep telling the team, you know, we're not selling brand strategy, and we're not even selling brand identity. Perhaps what we're selling is to companies is a new way to see themselves, and is a new sort of self-confidence. And I think the role of a good strategist is to identify an opportunity that is unique only to that company. So I think given the greater access to the C-suite, the role of brand, I think, particularly in Asia, is more expansive. Now, there are some CMOs who thrive on that, and some who shy away from that. But particularly also what technology is doing is it's allowing multiple business models to come to the forefront as well, right? So, for example, of course, and COVID has exaggerated that, but things like D2C, right, direct-to-consumer models, is absolutely top of mind for a lot of businesses, whether they're old institutional businesses or startups. And the fact is that who should really own that experience and that channel? You know, if there's a switched-on CMO who really understands the business picture, and I've been quite lucky to work with a few of them, they can have that impact, right? They can have sort of that business focus and drive growth for the business accordingly. They can have conversations with their HR teams. And, you know, I've had CMOs talk about if the promise of a brand is a certain way, then what does it mean for the kind of forms that people have to fill up first when they join the company? Because it's all linked, right? Like, you can't talk about, say, making life simpler for people on the outside, and then you have these multiple bureaucratic forms which are not doing anything, or you have too many rigid rules around working from home and things like that, right? So you've got to walk the talk internally and externally. And the CMOs who really think business first get that, and they get the opportunity to impact business models, impact, you know, employee journeys internally. And increasingly you'll find that there is perhaps more than the West opportunities for CMOs to step into the CEO roles here. So
interesting. And I guess, you know, historically, you're working in Middle East and Africa kind of region or zone, and then you obviously have the APAC region, and often there's been a regional CMO, especially for global, maybe Western established brands. But, you know, one, you're working with these, you know, Asian-born brands, and two, perhaps you're also seeing that power shift move towards where maybe a regional CMO is not so much of a gatekeeper anymore for a brand that's been kind of born in the West, but they're also able to perhaps drive something quite different when it comes to China, India, and obviously Southeast Asia as a whole. What's your sort of take on the, or what do you see when it comes to that kind of global versus regional CMO dynamic, and what does that mean for you?
Yeah, it's really interesting because, in fact, you know, you take some Western businesses and you look at their footprint, and a lot of their brands, international brands, perhaps only survive because of their business in Asia. Mm-hmm. So it's become that huge, right? Like, and you hear every other day, right? Like a big sort of multinational company shifting some of their headquarters to Asia as well. And they're not doing that because, and we've been lucky enough to work with a few of those. And they're not doing that because, you know, just it's easier to relocate everyone in Asia. They're doing that because the market is here, and the market of the future is increasingly here. So I think there is a lot of understanding of that. There is a lot of flexibility around how brands are being created around that. And in fact, it's almost started happening the other way as well, where innovations created specifically for you know, local markets or Asian markets are now being exported globally as well. So you see a lot of that happening. So again, it's a brilliant time to be related to the branding field or the marketing field in Asia, because perhaps like never before, the opportunity to do something of significance is really high.
Fantastic, Ambrish. So what we'll do now is bring a wrap to part one of our discussion. And there's lots to build on there as we take things down a notch to perhaps a more human level of discussion. So please tune in for the second installment, which we're titling Hacking Humans, where we'll dive into Ambrish's views around human understanding as a means of driving strategy.